Good evening. We are waiting for word tonight from a bipartisan group of four senators trying to reach agreement on some kind of gun legislation. John Cornyn, Tom Tillis, Chris Murphy, and Kyrsten Sinema, three representing states, Arizona, Connecticut, and Texas, that have seen some of the country's worst mass shootings over the years. Now, this afternoon, Senator Cornyn, the lead Republican negotiator, said the group might have, quote, something, unquote, after their meeting tonight. Exactly what? Unclear. There were at least 13 mass shootings in the country since Friday evening. That's 13 incidents in which four more people were shot. This is a map where they occurred from Phoenix to Philadelphia. This is also a look at locations of all the mass shootings so far this year, at least 246, and that's just so far. According to the Gun Violence Archive, which compiles these statistics, it puts the country on pace to match or exceed the worst year on record. Now, in a moment, we'll have the latest from Congress. First, though, CNN's Brian Todd on the weekend.
A physical altercation escalated into a shootout Saturday, according to police, with bullets flying into the crowd in an entertainment district. When police responded,
they observed several civilians suffering from gunshot wounds lying on the sidewalk and in the street.
Police believe there were at least three gunmen and at least four guns were used. 14 shot, three killed, one a suspected gunman. Charges have been filed today, including attempted murder against one of two suspects. One of them is already in custody. Authorities say a responding officer shot and injured him. The other still at large.
He has not been apprehended yet.
He is not.
Is he a dangerous person? Should he be out?
He is, of course. We've requested high bail once he is arrested.
In rural South Carolina, at a graduation lawn party with 150 guests, police say at least 60 or 70 shots were fired from two cars. Eight people were shot, one of them killed.
I looked at my daughter on the ground. She was out. She had already stopped breathing.
In Chattanooga, Tennessee, at a nightclub shooting, three people were killed and at least 14 injured, two from gunshots, one struck by a fleeing vehicle.
It's going to be a long summer, and we have got to get out in front of it and put a stop to it.
Additional shootings across the country this weekend, from a Michigan suburb to a graduation party in Virginia to a party at a strip mall in Phoenix.
Group of people that just started running like every different direction, and I myself was like hiding behind cars because the shots kept getting closer and closer.
Philadelphia's top prosecutor focusing on guns.
We have 120 guns for every 100 Americans, and that includes children. And so we find ourselves in situations where people who are simply having a fist fight can turn a street in a busy entertainment section of town into mayhem. It's disastrous.
New York's governor today signed bills including a ban on body armor sales and raising the age to purchase a semi-automatic rifle from 18 to 21.
When do we become a nation that reveres the right to have the ability to possess a gun over the right of a child to stay alive? When did that happen?
But in Washington, far less agreement on what to do. The mood in Philadelphia and elsewhere tonight?
I don't want to feel like I can't get home from work safe.
Brian Todd is in Philadelphia tonight. Do police have any leads on the suspect still at large there?
Anderson, if they have leads on him, they're being pretty cagey about it tonight. The DA's office being careful not to release the person's name. They do tell us that he remains very dangerous, is still out there. We have to reiterate, though, that they are piecing together information on scenes of sheer chaos from Saturday evening. The DA's office told us that the two men whose confrontation started this whole thing on Saturday night, they fired a total of about 17 shots at each other within just a few seconds.
Brian Todd, appreciate it. More now on the state of the Senate negotiations underway. This afternoon in the White House, spokesperson Karine Jean-Pierre said that the president is, in her words, encouraged by the talks. And a short time later on CNN's The Lead, Democratic Senator Chris Murphy told Jake Tapper he was cautiously optimistic.
I've never been part of negotiations as serious as these. There are more Republicans at the table talking about changing our gun laws and investing in mental health than at any time since Sandy Hook. Now, I've also been part of many failed negotiations in the past, so I'm sober-minded about our chances.
That was Senator Murphy earlier, before the talks tonight began. For more on how they're going, CNN's Jessica Dean joins us now from the Capitol. So is it likely this bipartisan group of senators will actually have something they can agree on soon?
Well, that's what they're hoping, clearly, Anderson, and they are up against time. They know that there is momentum right now, and they want to take advantage of that. But look, they still have to bridge a lot of gaps here. There's a lot to cover, and they are trying to work quickly, but they remain very clear-eyed that this could fall apart, even as they continue to meet as we speak tonight. The four senators, Senators Sinema, Murphy, Tillis, and Cornyn, all together tonight trying to kind of sort through what happens next. We know that some of the things that are on the table right now are incentivizing states to increase red flag laws or put them into place if they're not already into place. Safe storage, perhaps expanding background checks, school safety funding, also mental health funding. These are all some of the things that they are talking about right now. We also know that the full GOP Senate conference is going to meet tomorrow at lunch. Anderson, they'll kind of take the temperature of the GOP. Remember, as we've talked about many, many times with this evenly divided Senate, it's going to come down to what 10 Republicans will agree to. That is what is going to be able to pass, and that's the only way they're going to get anything through that Senate filibuster.
Is raising the age to 21 for buying semi-automatic rifles, which is something the president had called for. He also talked about a ban on assault weapons, but raising the age to 21 would be a step short of that. Is that on the table?
It doesn't appear to be on the table. My colleague Manu Raju did catch up with Senator Joe Manchin, of course, a conservative Democrat from West Virginia. I want everyone to listen to what he had to say about it earlier.
Here, you want to look at two things that could have prevented this. An age requirement would have prevented an 18-year-old, and basically a red flag law that's basically intended to try to help a person get some mental help.
Do you think that there should be a ban on assault weapons, ban on AR-15?
You know, talking about bans, I wouldn't have a problem on looking at some of these things. What is the necessity? Tell me what the purpose is, and let's use them for those purposes.
But again, they're going to need 10 Republicans to join them in that, Anderson, and there's absolutely no indication that a ban would go anywhere in the Senate. We do know that some of the lead negotiators were talking about potentially expanding a waiting period for 18 to 20-year-olds, for example, maybe looking into juvenile records to try to make sure that they are mentally fit to be able to have a weapon. That is something they're discussing. Again, we should learn more when they get out of this meeting tonight and then in tomorrow as well. Anderson.
All right. Just kidding. I appreciate the latest. Thanks. Perspective now from a lawmaker who has already expressed his impatience at the slow pace of gun legislation, Democratic Congressman David Cicilline of Rhode Island. He had this to say to Republican Matt Gaetz' objections in a hearing last week that red flag laws infringe on the right to due process.
Spare me the bullshit about constitutional rights. You know who didn't have due process? You know who didn't have their constitutional right to life respected? The kids at Parkland and Sandy Hook and Uvalde and Buffalo, and the list goes on and on.
Congressman Cicilline joins us now. How confident are you in the Senate to get this over the finish line?
Well, good evening. I don't have a lot of confidence about the Senate deliberations. I hope I'm wrong. What I can tell you is that we have passed two really important pieces of the legislation already. One, to strengthen criminal background checks. We know criminal background checks work because 3.5 million gun sales have been denied because someone went to buy a gun who wasn't legally allowed to. The problem is thousands and thousands of gun sales happen without a criminal background check. So we sent that bill to the Senate to strengthen criminal background checks. We sent a bill over to close the Charleston loophole so you don't get to buy a gun if your background check doesn't come back quickly enough, no matter what kind of criminal record you have. Those are very common sense, supported by 90% of the American people. They haven't even passed those because the Republicans are blocking consideration of those two really widely embraced pieces of legislation. We will pass this week in the House a red flag bill so that people who are seriously mentally ill, such that they're a danger to themselves or others, that they might commit a horrific crime, won't have the ability to buy a gun. This is, again, very common sense. Lots of states already do this. And then we'll also pass the Protecting Our America's Kids Act that will ban ghost guns and raise the age to own an assault weapon and prohibit trafficking in firearms. Provide right. for safe storage and high capacity magazines. So we're going to pass those and then we're going to send them over to the Senate and they're going to have a responsibility to answer to that, either to pass the bills we've passed, pass their own bill. But we've been here before, but Anderson, we have got, something has to be different this time. We have a gun violence epidemic in this country. Guns are now the leading cause of death of American kids. mean, think about that. We've had more than 27 school shootings this year, more than 200 mass shootings this year alone. And we have got to do something different. And this idea of just if everyone had a gun, if there were more guns, we'd be safer. If that were true, we'd be the safest country in the world because we have more guns in America than anywhere else in the world, more guns than people. Senator, we need to do something different. And I hope the Senate will do their job.
Yeah, Senator Cornyn outlined potential legislation compromises, strengthening mental health care, bolstering school security, keeping guns out of the hands of people who are already legally prohibited from having them. Clearly, those measures are not enough for you. Are they a positive step for you?
Absolutely. Look, I think we have got to make progress. The American people are begging their elected officials to do something to protect them from the scourge and the ravaging of gun violence in our country. And so I'm happy that I hope we're going to make some progress, but we're going to keep fighting for all of the common sense proposals that we're going to pass in the House because we know taken together, they will make a real difference in the lives of the people that we represent. And, you know, I just for the life of me cannot understand why people are unwilling to stand up to the powerful gun lobby and do what's right to safeguard the lives of their constituents.
But
when
you know
kids
what?
One can't of the, go to school but, and feel safe,
but one of the
or
things
can't
that,
go to a grocery store.
Yeah. President Biden, though, one of the things
I'm
he
sorry.
Said is that, you know, that for people, it may boil down to this becoming an issue that people actually vote on, whether, you know, at the polls, that this if people are really serious about this and really want change, it may be that the only way to make change happen is at the voting booth and by people making this the number one issue that drives their vote. That's not happened. I mean, it certainly hasn't on the Democratic side or those who want some form of, you know, raising an assault weapon ban or raising the age. That it's not the number one issue they're voting on.
Yeah, no, President Obama used to say that for us, you know, gun safety is on the list of many important issues, healthcare and education and climate. And for people who are opponents of responsible gun safety, it's very often the only issue. And this has to become a single issue for voters who want gun safety. No one should vote for a candidate who's not committed to doing everything in their power to reduce gun violence in this country and to pass common sense gun safety proposals. These proposals are supported by 90, 85% of the American people. Something is fundamentally broken when the vast majority of Americans are demanding this action and the Republicans in the Senate still prevent it from happening. So if it doesn't happen now, then I think you're absolutely right. It has to be a campaign issue and people have to be committed to ensuring they're not going to elect and vote for people who are going to stand in the way of responsible gun safety legislation in this country. Otherwise, we'll never get any change.
Yeah. Congressman Cicilline, I appreciate your time. Thanks very much.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up next, a live report from Uvalde on the continuing search for answers there. And later, candidates for office and the past connections to QAnon that they now, at least some of them, seem to be trying to back away from. Plus, more January 6th participants facing sedition charges ahead. As lawmakers negotiated the shape of possible new gun legislation back in Washington, Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas was in Uvalde. He laid flowers, paid respects at Robb Elementary, spoke with Border Patrol agents who had responded to the shooting and local officials, not to reporters, however. As for the kind of information that people in Uvalde are getting from those same officials to all the questions that everyone still has, grieving parents still have, about how the incident and the entire episode has been handled, well, that continues to be a problem. CNN's Shimon Procupes, who has seen a lot of it up close, joins us now with more from Uvalde. So what's it been like for families and reporters and anyone just trying to get basic information? I mean, are they giving out any new details at all about what actually occurred?
No, none, Anderson. You know, we keep getting sort of stalled and we keep getting the word from officials here that now that the district attorney's office is sort of in charge of this investigation with the Texas Rangers, that they can no longer provide information to us. So, you know, we still try. We still go to the governor's office. We still go to state investigators. We still go to the DA's office, but they continue to deny our requests for information. So it's been particularly difficult on the ground here to try and get updates on this investigation, what new information they've learned. There's still, as you said, so many unanswered questions. And, you know, it could really take weeks, if not months, before this report comes out from the Texas Rangers answering some of these remaining open-ended questions, Anderson.
What are the big questions that still, I mean, I guess there are so many of them, but what do you think the main things are that still need to be figured out?
So I think the beginning moments, you know, so much has been made about that hour, over an hour that the officers were in the hall as the gunman was still firing his weapon at those kids. But it's also the beginning moments. You know, we've heard a lot about this resource officer, the school police officer. Why wasn't this person at the school? Were they supposed to be at the school? But those moments in the beginning of the gunfire, when the gunman entered the school, those 5-6 minutes, the officers retreated. They moved back. He was firing at them. So we need some explanation as to why that is. That's not what protocol is, right? Protocol is you go towards the gunfire. These officers, from everything we've been told, retreated. They moved back. They moved to get cover, allowing the gunman even more time, more effort to get into that classroom and sadly kill those children.
There's a state house hearing scheduled for Thursday. Is there anything we should expect to learn from that?
So it's the investigative committee that they formed here on the Robb Elementary shooting. I think some of it, most of it is probably going to be conducted behind closed doors because they're going to also argue they're still an active investigation. But this committee is going to have subpoena power. It's going to be able to depose people. They say they're bringing in law enforcement to testify. So we'll see. Again, the big question, though, is if they keep doing this behind closed doors, how are we ever going to get answers, you know, these investigations that are taking place. When it was convenient for them to answer questions, Anderson, as we've said, they were answering questions. They stood before a podium. They took as many questions as we wanted. They made appearances. But once the story became different, once we started questioning the stories that law enforcement was providing us, all of a sudden, well, everything now is under investigation. And so they're not answering any questions. And it's really everybody in the state, everywhere we turn, everyone is saying because the district attorney's office is now running this investigation, they're not going to answer questions.
Shmuel Brokovich, appreciate it. Thank you. One of the teachers wounded at Robb Elementary School is speaking out. Here's what he told ABC News.
He started asking out loud, Mr. Reyes, what is going on? And I said, I don't know what's going on, but let's go ahead and get under the table. Get under the table and act like you're asleep. As they were doing that, and I was gathering them under the table and told them to act like they were going to sleep, is about the time when I turned around and saw him standing there. One of the students from the next door classroom was saying, Officer, we're in here. We're in here. And then, but they had already left. And then, he got up from behind my desk and he walked over there and he shot over there again.
Robb Elementary teacher wounded in the shooting. Now, someone who's been searching for answers in his legislative capacity, Texas State Senator Roland Gutierrez joins us. He represents Uvalde. He joins us now. Senator Gutierrez, appreciate you being with us. You heard our reporting from Shimon Pocupes. Getting any answers, it's remarkable to me how silent now everyone from law enforcement to the governor is about what actually occurred. There was a shooting in Tulsa. Within 12 hours, we knew all about it from police. We knew the times. We knew who had done what. Why is there this wall of silence now?
Anderson, your guess is as good as mine. I've been demanding answers to important questions. I was told that I was going to get a very vital report for me. I wanted to know which officers were in that hallway, not to identify them, but I wanted to know which law enforcement units were in there. The last thing I was told, that it began with 2 state troopers and as many as 13 state troopers were in that hallway. That's an important issue for me because those are the folks that are accountable to me at the state legislature. My concern here is that there's a lot of finger pointing. No one seems to know who the incident commander is. We've been told that it's this one school cop. At what point does the next agency with higher firepower, higher equipment, not take command and control? DPS is always talking about command and control, clearly the superior power, and clearly there was some breakdown in the entire system here. Big concern for me going forward, Anderson.
The Speaker of the Texas House of Representatives has formed an investigative committee focusing on the shooting at Robb Elementary. That committee meets this Thursday. Do you expect to learn anything from that investigation? Who is on that committee?
Well, you know, I'm in the Senate, not in the House. The Senate has yet to meet, and I believe the lieutenant governor said he's going to wait till all the funerals passed, which will be next week. I have no idea what their information they're going to be able to glean or what information they're going to get, because the local district attorney has shut this whole process down. Listen, if there's some criminality out there, I understand that. But it remains to be seen what criminality we could be discussing. Clearly, there was law enforcement error, self-identified and admitted law enforcement error by Colonel McCraw. I just want to know where that blame should go. Why is that important? Less to blame people, but more to make sure that this never happens again. We need joint training with law enforcement entities on the border. That never happened here. That was admitted to me. We need organizations to be on the same communication level. We heard that this man was the incident commander, but then DPS tells us that he doesn't have radio communications. So did he raise his hand? Was he wearing a shirt? How did he tell these folks that he was the incident commander? There's just so many just questions out here that it just had not been answered for us.
And I think
community's very frustrated.
I think you also make a really important point that our desire to get answers, I'm sure the grieving family's desire to get answers, it's not to blame somebody. It's not to, you know, publicly humiliate somebody who made a bad call or wrong decision or didn't have training or whatever it may be. It's to figure out what went wrong so it doesn't happen again. Because, I mean, if police forces don't have the training that they're supposed to have by now, if they don't have the knowledge of how to deal with an active shooter, those are all important things to know. I'm stunned. I've never seen a kind of a wall of silence like this put up around an incident where so many people have been killed. Texas State Senator Roland Gutierrez, I appreciate your time tonight. I know you keep trying to get answers to questions. We'll continue as well. Thank you. Coming up, Russia returns the bodies of Ukrainian soldiers killed during the siege on the steel plant in Mariupol and in other areas of the city. As Russia steps up airstrikes and its land offensive in eastern Ukraine, a live report from the war zone next. We approach the four-month mark in Vladimir Putin's war in Ukraine. Russia is stepping up its ground and air offensive in the eastern part of the country, with Ukrainian officials saying the situation is changing every hour. There are reports of fierce battles, and Russian forces try to break down Ukrainian defenses and hit key infrastructure. Also, Russia is returning some of Ukraine's war dead. For the latest, I want to go see CNN's Ben Wiedemann in Kramatorsk in eastern Ukraine. So, Ben, President Zelensky spoke earlier this evening. What did he have to say?
Well, it's sort of a wide-ranging interview with the media, Anderson, and basically he did underscore the difficulties faced by Ukrainian forces in that city, Severodonetsk, about an hour and a half drive from here. That's been a fierce battle now for several weeks. But he also talked about what happened in Mariupol, that city on the Azov Sea that was under siege for 2 months. He said he believed that perhaps as many as 2,500 of the soldiers taken prisoner by the Russians may be in the Luhansk and Donetsk areas occupied by Russia. He said that the priority for the Ukrainians is now to bring them home. But what we saw on Saturday in Kyiv's central morgue is some of the bodies that the Russians handed back to the Ukrainians.
And so begins, on a sunny summer morning, the grimmest of tasks. Workers at Kyiv's central morgue examined the contents of 160 dirty, putrid body bags, containing the badly decomposed remains of soldiers killed during the two-month siege at the port city of Mariupol and in the city's sprawling Azovstal steel plant, where Ukrainian forces made their last stand. Ukraine and Russia have conducted an exchange of bodies as part of the agreement that ended the siege. Forensic examiner Lilia Filipchuk has been on the job for 3 years. Since the war began, she's had little rest. We also examined the bodies from Bucha and Irpin, she says, referring to Kyiv suburbs where retreating Russian forces are accused of committing atrocities against civilians. Elena Tolkachova is also helping. She's affiliated with the Azov Brigade, which fought in Mariupol. The brigade is a nationalist militia that was integrated into Ukraine's armed forces. The morgue is already full of bodies from Kyiv, from Bucha, from Irpin, she says. So we have to put them in a refrigerator truck. Morgue workers search the ripped and ragged clothing for documents and tag and bag personal items. This is just the start of a long process.
Some of these bodies have no identification, so their DNA will have to be sampled. And it may take a month, maybe more, to find out who they were.
And only then will their loved ones know their fate. Finality for the living and the dead will have to wait.
It's that whole process, it's unbelievable. As we mentioned, you're now in Kramatorsk. You were there after the attack on the train station, people may remember, back in April. What have you been seeing in Kramatorsk?
Not so much as what we've been seeing, what we've been hearing. We've been hearing a lot of explosions overnight. It's not quite clear where they're coming from, since they're sort of all over the place. But certainly what is the difference from when I was here before is how much more on edge this city is. The Russians have made progress in taking more ground since I was here in late April. What we saw, for instance, when we were coming here yesterday, was that going westward were many cars lined up at checkpoints, people leaving the area, even though the Ukrainians continue to try to keep the Russians at bay. Many people fear that the country's hold on this part of the country isn't quite so firm as it used to be.
Yeah. Ben Wiedemann.
Anderson.
I appreciate it, Ben. Thank you so much. Up next, the Republican candidates for Congress who once seemingly pushed QAnon conspiracies. What did they say about it now? Find out ahead. Tonight, the leader of the so-called Proud Boys and four other top lieutenants in the far-right extremist group face seditious conspiracy charges. These are the most serious charges brought by the Justice Department as part of the ongoing investigation into the violent insurrection on Capitol Hill last year. Federal prosecutors accuse Enrique Tarrio and his co-defendants of plotting the attack in advance and encouraging supporters to stop Congress from certifying the 2020 election. The men have already pleaded not guilty to earlier charges. Meanwhile, another group getting more attention since the attack on the Capitol is QAnon, or Q. Many of those who attacked the Capitol were followers or supporters. The supporters of QAnon spread all sorts of anti-Semitic and nonsensical conspiracies and disinformation. They have found a niche on social media, certainly, and within the Republican Party. But CNN's Daniel Sullivan discovered some GOP candidates who've seemingly supported QAnon beliefs in the past may now trying to be distancing themselves from it. Take a look.
With the whole COVID thing, and a lot of people say it's a plandemic, okay. I don't know if that's true or not. I'm open to the possibility of anything because I see how much we've been lied to.
Nicholas Ferreira is running in the Republican primary for New Jersey's 3rd Congressional District. He is a QAnon diehard.
Somebody watching this might say, how does somebody as intelligent and put together as you are go down the QAnon rabbit hole and believe it?
Because I've seen the evidence.
False QAnon predictions, like this one in 2017, which claimed that Hillary Clinton was about to be arrested, have not deterred Ferreira.
Does the fact that so much of this was bullshit not put you off it?
Well, now, you could say that, though. They always say future proofs past, so these things, they didn't happen, like the Clinton thing. But supposedly they can happen in the future to the day, let's say 3-4 years to the day. We'll see.
One of the ways that we found you was you were on this list pulled together by the liberal group Media Matters. They identify you as a QAnon candidate. Are you a QAnon candidate?
You know, I don't know anything about that. I have no idea what they're talking about. There's zero evidence.
Darlene Swaffer, who is running in Florida's 22nd Congressional District, denies knowing anything about QAnon, despite posts referencing the conspiracy theory on her social media.
They have a screenshot of you in a QAnon group, QAnon Great Awakening, where you say, your posts have inspired me to explore to run for Congress in 2020.
Yeah, I think we're definitely focused on uncovering the truth. We want to know what corruption's going on in our country.
What is the QAnon slogan?
Well, there's a number. Where we go one, we go all, I guess is the main one.
Where does that come from, where we go one, where we go all?
It's a good question. I do know that JFK had it on the back of his boat. There was like a bell and it was etched into that bell.
Where we go one, we go all.
Do you know that that slogan came from John F. Kennedy? That's where that came from. And that slogan was on his yacht, his boat.
That's a popular answer for QAnon believers who want to deny they embrace the conspiracy theory slogan, but it's not true. CNN asked the John F. Kennedy Presidential Library, which said it had found no evidence that the phrase had anything to do with Kennedy's boats or any indication he had said the phrase.
Nice dive, Preston.
In fact, the slogan seems to come from Hollywood on the boat of Ridley Scott's 1996 disaster survival movie, White Squall.
Where we go one, we go all.
I mean, we've spoken to some other Republican primary candidates who have tweeted QAnon stuff in the past, but now they're trying to distance themselves from it. They're saying, I don't follow Q.
Sure.
Why do you think they're doing that?
Because they get attacked nonstop.
I thought QAnon said they're in the cabal.
They're in the cabal, well.
And then there's Darren Aquino, a New Yorker who moves south. He's running in Florida's 25th district.
That's me and Jimmy on The Sopranos.
His Twitter account has multiple past references to QAnon.
A few times you did tweet the QAnon slogan, where we go one, we go all.
I didn't tweet that. At the beginning, I didn't tweet my tweets because I'm not very technical. Right. So I had people, they tweet for me.
Okay.
Darren says he knows nothing about QAnon, but that he did believe a conspiracy theory after the 2020 election that martial law might be put in place to stop Biden's inauguration. He says he even stocked up on canned goods and other supplies.
Those concerns about martial law in January 2021, as somebody who's followed QAnon, the conspiracy theory movement, a lot of those claims that all this madness was going to happen in January 21.
Was that QAnon, are you saying, that put this stuff out?
I'm saying the community around QAnon was what was pushing it, what was pushing these claims, which turned out to be false. They never materialized.
Okay, so what I was getting came actually from QAnon.
I would say from the kind of QAnon community.
Okay. I got it from people that knew me in other states.
Yeah.
They were telling me, Darren, this is going to be, get ready. Okay, what are we getting ready for?
Would you say you're a victim of misinformation?
Yeah, but I wouldn't make it like I'm a weak victim. Because I'm a patriot. So somebody, look at it from this one. Let's tell that patriot, because he'll spread the word. So yeah, I'm a victim of somebody's lie to use my credibility and my patriotism to spread a word that's a lie.
And Donny joins me now. The putting aside to him, the other two seem clearly to have been pushing tweets about QAnon, and now, I mean, the first one seems to be standing by it. The Miss
Darlene
Swafford. She now just seems to be pretending like that didn't happen.
That's right, and we've kind of seen that with more candidates.
Believing it didn't happen.
Yeah, more and more candidates, GOP, who have realized that the QAnon label, it's gone out of vogue, you know, given the likes of the QAnon shaman and things like that. But what we're seeing really is that the belief system that has been popularized through the kind of QAnon movement still lives on. I mean, you heard from Ms. Swafford there. She still believes the election was stolen, and she cites evidence from the pillow guy, Mike Lindell, to prove that. And then to the more dark side of it, we didn't touch it on this piece, but, you know, there is that belief system where that anybody who disagrees with Trump or disagrees with the Republicans is a pedophile. And that was popularized through the QAnon movement. And we saw even recently, Elise Stefanik, the number three in the House Republicans, she tweeted recently a reference to pedophiles. So we can see that this belief structure is still in place and alive and well.
It's also fascinating. I mean, you hear Nicholas Ferrer there, you know, quoting the QAnon slogan and saying, well, you know, well, I do know that came from Kennedy's boat. You know, like everything with QAnon, it's just not true.
I mean, look.
And also him saying, well, yes, that whole Clinton thing, Clinton wasn't arrested, but supposedly it can happen 3 years from now on that same date. I don't even know what that means.
Look, I think, you know, we hear so much from people where they say, I do my own research. I go online, I do my own research. If they did their own research, they might have been able to see that JFK never said where we go and where we go, where the image of that bell that is circulating online is actually from that very good movie, which I know you enjoy, Anderson White Squaw. I don't think they often realize, particularly on that point, to say, oh, well, this prediction didn't work out, but it could in 2 or 3 years' time. I don't think they quite realize how ridiculous it sounds when they say it out loud.
It's fascinating, Tony Sullivan. Keep at it. Thanks. I don't know how you do it. Coming up, the latest details on the gunman suspected of killing a former Wisconsin judge and the other public figure sources say he was potentially targeting. We have new details tonight on the gunman suspected of shooting to death retired Wisconsin judge John Romer in his home on Friday. According to court documents, more than 15 years ago, Judge Romer sentenced the suspect to 6 years in jail. Now authorities are calling the judge's killing a targeted attack. And sources tell CNN that Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell and Wisconsin's Governor Tony Evers were also potential targets. Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer's office said her name was also on the gunman's list. CNN's Nadia Romero has the latest on it.
At 6:30 a.m., the Juneau County Sheriff's Office received a call about an armed person and 2 shots fired inside a home in New Lisbon, Wisconsin. They responded and for nearly 4 hours tried to negotiate with a suspect inside the home before entering and finding 68-year-old retired Judge John Romer zip-tied to a chair, according to 2 sources familiar with the investigation. Police say he was shot and killed.
This act appears to have been related to the judicial process.
Police found the suspected attacker injured in the basement from an apparent self-inflicted gunshot wound. He survived. Investigators are now looking into the possibility of a targeted attack, potentially part of a hit list of public figures, according to a source familiar with the investigation.
All I can say is that he's in critical condition and the investigation's ongoing.
No charges have been filed. The suspect in the shooting has criminal convictions dating back to at least 2002 and has crossed paths with Judge Romer in the past. Court records show in 2005, his case involving armed burglary and firearms charges came before the judge, who sentenced him to 6 years in prison, followed by 9 years extended supervision. The suspect also brought a civil suit against several law enforcement officials after his 2001 arrest. Judge Romer was targeted along with other political leaders.
There were other targets. Judge Romer was among them. And the investigation into those details is continuing. We notified everybody who we had reason to believe may have been a target.
And for all of
those targets, according to the source, included Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer, and Wisconsin Governor Tony Evers. Judge Romer retired in 2017. Timothy Cottingham, a Juneau County Board chairman who worked with Judge Romer for close to 30 years, says the legal community is still in shock.
I think that's part of the healing process. It's going to take time, like with everything. A lot of people have dealt with him, you know, personally, professionally. It's tough. He was a very good man.
This is such a horrific crime. This is a targeted attack on a public official and a judge. It's not the only targeted attack we've seen.
The state's attorney general said identifying any further potential threats is now a primary concern.
We have seen a rise in domestic extremism. I think it is important that we take a look at the protective measures that we have in place.
And Nadia Romero joins me now from Wisconsin. What can you tell us about the tribute this evening for the judge?
Yeah, Anderson, it was so emotional for the people involved. This building behind me is the Old County Courthouse. This is where Judge John Romer started his career as a public defender. And then for the next few decades, he worked with many county employees. And they walked out of this building so that they could see this flag being lowered at half staff at the request of the county board chairman, who wanted to honor the late Judge John Romer. And we saw those county employees hugging one another and sobbing over his sudden loss. And the community will gather again, not too far from here at the Justice Center where he served as a judge. There will be a candlelight vigil on Friday. Anderson.
What's reaction been in the town?
I mean, Anderson, this is such a small town, and we often hear the cliche, it's a tight, close-knit community. I mean, that couldn't be even more truer when you're talking about this area. Everyone seems to know everyone. If you need to go to the grocery store from the judge's home in New Lisbon, you'd have to travel more than 2 miles to get those everyday staples. We went to his church, St. Paul's, and when I spoke with a woman who knew him and his family, she couldn't get words out before she started crying and told me that it was just too emotional for her. Nothing like this happens in this kind of town. The county board chairman told me that he was a police officer for 27 years. He can only remember 5 homicides in those 27 years. Anderson?
Nadia Romero, appreciate the reporting. Thank you. Up next, today as we mark the anniversary of D-Day, we remember the troops who risked their lives when they stormed the beaches of Normandy, attacked Nazi soldiers in World War II. Today marks the 78th anniversary of D-Day, the day considered the turning point of World War II. And several dozen D-Day veterans, now all in their 90s, gathered on the beaches of Normandy to remember the moment. On June 6, 1944, more than 150,000 U.S. and other Allied troops stormed those beaches to attack German troops. It was the largest land and water invasion in history. An estimated 10,000 Allied troops were killed, wounded, or went missing in action. More than 6,000 were Americans. Now, nearly 8 decades later, the Best Defense Foundation brought World War II veterans back to Normandy to commemorate the anniversary. According to the foundation, about 20,000 people came to meet the veterans during a parade today. The parade was held in a town liberated by American paratroopers during the Normandy invasion. We remember and thank them. The news continues. I want to hand it over to Laura Coates and CNN Tonight. Laura?
Now streaming exclusively on Max. A new CNN flash doc about the album that has Nashville talking, Call Me Country, Beyonce and Nashville's Renaissance. Watch it at max.com/callmecountry. Max subscription required.